Welcome to Oncology Today, this program focused on key presentations in gynecologic cancers from the 2023 ASCO meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Flor Backus from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. In addition to this interview, there's also a video recording featuring Dr. Backus's full-length slide presentation. During her presentation, Dr. Backus commented on the anti-HER2 antibody-drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan in patients with gynecologic malignancies. And to begin, I asked for her thoughts on the clinical use of this agent.
Yes, I mean, this is a great result. I think there's a couple of things to it. Would I use it? Absolutely, if I can get it and get insurance to approve it. If a clinical trial is not available, I think definitely doing more studies, identifying these patients is really important, and getting, this is a cohort of 40 or so patients per disease type. So we definitely need larger numbers. So I think that would be the first thing, but this is something that is going to be big, like you said, across all tumor types, lots of experience already in some of the other disease types. Non-GYN related. I think the other portion of this is that we're oftentimes forgetting at the moment, we're not standard testing. We may be sending NGS, but we're not doing immunohistochemistry standard for our cervical cancer for HER2. PD-L1. But we're going to have to add HER2 immunohistochemistry really for all endometrials, all ovarians in this case. And this is certainly not something that we've discussed here within our group also after this presentation. Like, gosh, we need to make a change. We need to start including these patients and not just look at mutations and is there an ERBB2 mutation or alteration, amplification, whatever it is. But yes, absolutely, immunohistochemistry is going to have to be part of it.
So I guess the other thing, you know, in terms of, you know, kind of work up the another issue would be MSI testing. Obviously, you're going to do that in endometrial cancer. Have you ever seen an MSI high ovarian cancer, incidentally?
Some probably more in the patients that were instantly diagnosed also with Lynch syndrome in right. That case. We don't test it as often. It's just not been all that exciting in ovarian cancer yet, and certainly not as common as what we see in endometrial cancer.
The other issue about T-DXd, as you were referring to, not just breast, but lung cancer, it's approved, upper GI cancer, a lot of good data in colon, that probably will get approved. But of course, the issue there also is the issue of side effects. And incidentally, have you ever used T-DXd yourself?
On trial, yeah.
I was curious because one of the things we've been hearing from all these different groups is the issue of chemotherapy-like side effects, nausea, vomiting, hair loss sometimes. Have you observed that? And do you, in general, would you pre-medicate a patient at just like, you know, kind of like they're getting chemo?
Yeah. Well, they are getting chemo. It certainly is a high potent payload that comes with this. So certainly they're getting just a more targeted form of chemotherapy. But I guess there's also a bystander effect that it's not just causing it to go into the cancer. Yes, mostly into the cancer cells where it delivers their action, but still we see nausea, fatigue, neutropenia, low rates of the grade 3, but having medications on hand, yes. Certainly pneumonitis even.
Yeah, that was the other thing I was going to ask you about, pneumonitis, which, you know, of course, there actually have been deaths reported, mm-hmm. although I think that was more and more advanced disease. And I guess one of the questions comes up is screening for pneumonitis. It looks, I'm seeing in breast cancer, they do a lot of pulmonary imaging, even if there's no tumor in the chest, looking to try to pick it up asymptomatically with the idea that to try to hold the therapy while they're asymptomatic. Do you see that strategy being applied in gynecologic cancers?
I think a lot of people will do, if we do imaging for treatment response, we'll include a CT scan. A lot of the agents, I think, that we've used to date, PARP inhibitors, certainly we see some pneumonitis, also immunotherapy, of course, but to see the severe, more severe kinds of that, we're still in the 1% to 2% range. I think as we are treating more with immunotherapy, with these antibody drug conjugates, we're going to see more of these, the pneumonitis need to get ourselves familiarized with. So if it's not standard yet, we may need to start thinking about at least a baseline scan to have a comparison if the patient starts presenting with symptoms or has any changes in the oxygen saturation to bring this to the forefront of our mind. I think there's still a lot of learning for us to do as we get ourselves more familiar with these new classes of drugs.
So I wanted to sort of throw out to you the common questions that docs in practice have about these cancers and get your take on how you approach that and whether any of these data that you presented from ASCO relate to that. We'll start out with ovarian cancer. And of course, one of the big issues there is primary maintenance therapy. I guess we can start out with the HRD population, BRCA population. How are you generally thinking through primary management of those patients? Maybe we can start with neoadjuvant therapy. How do you decide between neoadjuvant therapy and sending a patient to surgery?
Yeah, a couple of factors that will go into that. I think everybody, to start with, I think everybody should have an evaluation with a gynecologic oncologist at some point, because this is really the most important part where first we have to establish care, but also probably the best point to decide, is a patient fit for surgery or not? That is, I would say that's probably the most important deciding factor, even if the disease is easy to remove, but the patient's not strong enough for surgery or fit or willing to undergo an extensive surgery, then that is off the table. And we would have to start with neoadjuvant. But given that if the patient is good enough for surgery, and that there's no age related to that. So there's certainly 55-year-olds that are much less fit than a 75 or 80-year-old. So we can't exclude based on age or factors like that. But if we're not going to be able to do a complete debulking where there's multiple hepatic metastases or lung metastases in those patients, we're just not going to get a complete gross resection or even optimal resection in many times. And those are the times that, yes, absolutely, we should start with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. But then it's also important to think about how many cycles we want to get these patients to surgery as soon as it's feasible to do surgery and get a complete debulking. As there's still some thought that the longer we give chemotherapy for before going to surgery, that you may develop some more resistant clones if there's more chemotherapy given. So ideally, you would want to go to surgery after 3 or after 4 cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy and then give more chemotherapy afterwards again.
And how do you approach the issue of whether to use Bev or not, either in the neoadjuvant or post-surgical situation?
Mm-hmm. Starting with the neoadjuvant, that's a little bit more tricky because certainly you're going to have to hold it. So you could only give it for 2 or 3 cycles prior to surgery. So in most instances, I will use just chemotherapy in that situation, unless the patient has a lot of ascites, pleural effusions that are very symptomatic and will not dry up. Or if the patient's not responding to chemotherapy, if they're after 3 cycles and they're still, their CA125 has not budged, their disease on exam is not improving. In those instances, bevacizumab can be very helpful to induce a response when you add it. So that would be some situations after surgery. It is obviously it's approved for all patients in the HR proficient population. We're using it more and more again as maintenance, as this is not a population probably where PARP inhibitor maintenance is indicated just as much or provides as much of a benefit. And then again, those patients who have high risk factors for recurrence and you want, also want to continue something for maintenance treatment afterwards, adding bevacizumab is a great option here.
What about the use of PARP in patients with BRCA and other HRD abnormalities? How do you approach, first of all, choice of a PARP inhibitor and also duration?
Depends on the indications. We currently have two that are FDA approved, three on the NCCN guidelines. But speaking about the two that are FDA approved, olaparib would be for either a tumor or germline BRCA mutation, and it's limited to just that. Or if the patient is HRD positive with a genomic instability score of greater than 42, in that case, you could do olaparib with bevacizumab. So that would be a first deciding factor in those cases. I think the data speaks for itself. Huge differences, years, not just a couple months, as we see with bevacizumab, but here we're speaking of not 4 months, but 3-4 years in addition to placebo. So absolutely, these patients have to have the option, have to be provided with the option of a PARP inhibitor with or without bevacizumab. And then for those, the more difficult to choose population is that population that is HR proficient, who still also can get niraparib. So can the germline or the tumor BRCA mutated. Of course, they can get olaparib or niraparib. But then the HR proficient also, the niraparib is FDA approved. So the benefit is less, 3 to 4 months compared to placebo, but still there is a benefit. And this is really kind of where we get into the patient-physician discussion of risk of side effects versus the benefit risk-benefit ratio.
And what about duration? And niraparib was used in the trials for 3 years. Olaparib is 2 years. Do you do that? Or if you're going to use a niraparib, for example, with a BRCA, do you use it for 2 years?
Yeah, excellent question. This is, I'm following for that. I'm going by the trial. So typically we'll do niraparib for 3 years or olaparib for 2 years. We just don't know. Maybe even 1 year would be sufficient. Who knows? Maybe we'll find that out in the future. But yeah, I'll stick to the trials, but I do not go beyond that. I think there's enough data coming out also that with platinum and PARP use, there's also, we have to think about other just a general side effects, certainly the cost of treatment also, and as well as the risk of myelodysplastic syndrome or acute myeloid leukemias, especially in the BRCA mutation. BRCA mutated population is maybe a little bit higher. Fortunately, we're not seeing that much in the upfront population, just 1-2% or so, but a little bit more in the recurrent population. So there's a whole separate discussion, but I think sticking to what the, where we have the safety data, and not extending that interval, we just don't know that 2 years or 3 years, anything more than 3 years is going to be better than just that.
Any situations where you would use niraparib plus Bev? I know there's no phase 3 data, but there are some safety data out there. And as you mentioned, niraparib is indicated with HR proficient. So have you or would you use it with Bev in a patient who otherwise met one of your criteria for Bev?
Yeah. The Ovario trial certainly showed that that data for, but it's a single arm study. All patients received a niraparib with Bev, and of course that study also showed that it was better in the BRCA mutated and HRD positive populations compared to HRD negative populations. I haven't used that personally as much, that combination. We don't have any randomized comparative data in this situation, although you would have to imagine that it probably can be too much different from olaparib with bevacizumab, but we just don't have any phase 3 randomized data for that.
I'm curious what your experience has been in the primary maintenance situation with side effects like GI side effects and also cytopenias with PARP inhibitors. Can you comment on that, those two issues?
Yeah. The GI side effects, first of all, absolutely. Some patients are much more bothered with that. I think most important is that when you inform the patient about it, you prescribe something like ondansetron or 5-HT3 blocker or other nausea medication as you give the patients their PARP inhibitor so that they can take that preventatively and prophylactically 30 minutes before they take their PARP inhibitor. I think that can avoid a lot of the nausea and even anticipatory nausea afterwards. So that part is important. And then the other part is to inform the patient also whether they can take it with or without food. But most of the GI side effects seem to resolve on its own after about the first 3 months. So getting the patient really through those first 3 months is really important, supporting them as good as you can, adjusting their nausea medications. But I think it's very manageable for the majority of patients that I prescribe it for. Rarely really that the dose reduction for it is needed. I think monitoring your blood counts is obviously important. Olaparib, we have to think about the thrombocytopenia. That risk is certainly less with the weights and plates and an individualized dosing that you want to adhere to. But still, the risk of thrombocytopenia is high, and for especially in the first 7 to 14 days. So checking those the blood counts and particularly looking at platelets weekly during that first cycle is very, very important. But the good thing is that with a dose reduction, holding it and then starting at a reduced dose, it usually doesn't return, and it's not typically not a recurring issue. And then, of course, the general anemia that we see with all PARP inhibitors also has to be monitored.
Any comments on the use of PARP inhibitors in patients who had prior PARP therapy in the primary maintenance situation? I guess you could break that down into people who relapse while they're on the PARP inhibitor as opposed to somebody who relapses afterwards. Any situations where you try to repeat it?
This is a great question. If I would have to follow the ASCO guidelines, which are fairly strict, I would have to say no. PARP after PARP is not indicated. But I think you bring to excellent points there. That's very generalized, but there's very different situations, and I think we're going to see more of this. Whereas PARP after PARP, when those guidelines were coming out, it was more if you had PARP in the platinum sensitive recurrent setting, should you do it again after the second or third platinum recurrence? Is probably very different than that patient that is on the BRCA mutated patient that is on olaparib for 2 years, then is off a PARP inhibitor for 2 years, and now 4 years after completing their initial platinum treatment has their first platinum sensitive recurrence. In that case, I'm going to treat them again with a platinum, and absolutely I would consider putting them on a PARP inhibitor again after discussion, because they're probably still sensitive. We just stopped because time was up. We did the two years and they didn't progress, but very different situations. So I think there's definitely going to be instances, and we're going to learn more about that with caution.
So maybe you can take a shot at explaining the situation with later line use of PARP inhibitor and the FDA pulling various approvals in the later line situation without getting into, I mean, you can get people to talk about this for a couple hours, but maybe boiling it down to less than a minute, what are the situations right now where you can use a PARP inhibitor and which PARP inhibitor in the later line situation?
Yeah. None of them are FDA approved anymore, but for sure off label, I think there's still a role. There's still patients out there that have never seen a PARP inhibitor, whether that was by choice or were never offered one. So that patient that has a platinum sensitive recurrence, who is BRCA mutated and never has had a PARP, we have data, we have great data in Ariel-4 that the PARP inhibitor is no less than platinum-based treatment. And for those patients who just don't want to have chemotherapy again, PARP inhibitors are great. Patients with a RAD51 mutation who may never have received one, also very, very sensitive to PARP, and they don't want a don't want active chemotherapy. PARP is great, and I have several patients who are very, very happy to be on a PARP and feel like they're on nothing and doing great.
So a couple other things that you had some updates on, but I'm curious to learn more. One is mirvetuximab, and I'm curious about your clinical experience with the agent, particularly in terms of tolerability issues and the ophthalmic issues. Sort of how does that actually play out in practice?
Yeah. Yeah, we do have a lot of experience here. We participated in the trials and then also had investigator initiated trials in this. So we've seen quite a bit of it and used it in combinations here also. But as a whether it's that or in single agent, I think overall it's very well tolerated. And those graphs that we saw were as far as nausea, maybe slightly less or similar to other chemotherapy agents. Hematologic, actually very much easier to use, especially for patients who have had prior treatment that have had issues with their counts. I think it's a great option for that. Those patients that don't want to have get alopecia, that's beneficial. As far as the eye, yes, it is intensive for patients to not be able to wear their contacts, to have to do the steroid drops, the lubricating drops before and after treatment, and see an ophthalmologist or some kind of eye doctor, I should say, every other cycle to keep monitoring. It's important. It's important preventative medicine. And just the side effects that you see on the cornea are different than what we see from conjunctivitis with some of the other ADCs that are a little bit easier clinically to recognize. But here you just have patients that complain of some blurry vision, and they may have all this keratitis that you just can't see with the naked eye. And we really need our eye colleagues to take a look at this to make sure that patients get this safely. But it's doable. And I think the fact that it doesn't have to be an ophthalmologist anymore, there's now forms that we send the patients home with. They give that to their eye care person. They fill it out and they bring it back to us and we make adjustments as needed. So that has certainly made it much easier for the patients and the whole care team.
I was telling your colleague, Dr. O'Malley, that I have this thing. I like kind of cool trial names, and I really like the Gloriosa name. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of curious, which, of course, you were talking about in your talk there with Bev and Merv. But I'm kind of curious where you see Merv landing. How early do you think it's going to be utilized in treatment? Do you see it potentially? I don't even know. Maybe there are trials you've been looking at it now. Do you see it potentially moving into the upfront situation?
Yeah, there's certainly trials that are going to be using it and replacing paclitaxel. So using this as the taxane therapy and avoiding alopecia that comes with it, then maybe lowering the hematologic side effects, neuropathy, slightly lower them with Taxol. So sure, I see it moving there. I'm curious to see how this will go as a maintenance treatment. It's still chemotherapy. We've done taxanes in the maintenance situation in the past where patients were getting Taxol every 3 weeks. With older trials that did not end up showing a significant benefit, or at least not benefit that outweighed the risks and the side effects also. So I don't know. I'll be curious to see. Maintenance is certainly something. I mean, the risk of ovarian cancer coming back is so high that having a maintenance strategy is probably a good thing. And we'll see how effective it is, but also how accepting patients are going to be of the combination as a maintenance treatment.
You also were talking about another antibody drug conjugate, UPRI. I stick with the nickname also. Have you had patients on trial receive the agent, and kind of what's quality of life like? What are some of the toxicities you see with UpRi?
Yeah, we have to probably mention that the trials are currently on hold for some concern of life-threatening bleeding. So development is halted until there's some more, consent forms and the trials are amended for additional safety issues. But overall, I think it depends, very patient dependent. We certainly see more nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain are more common with the drug. Some patients tolerate it better than others. Some require some preventative IV fluids, weekly IV fluids to prevent the nausea, diarrhea, and abdominal pain also. So certainly still some things that we need to work out. How can we best support these patients? But nausea, abdominal pain are probably the biggest things. And using a good anti-emetic prophylactic and treatment regimen also before infusion and afterwards is very, very important for patients to be able to stay on the drug.
You mentioned the hold that I think it was just in the last couple of weeks. Any thoughts about that? Sometimes trials get held and you know that it's really not going to turn into anything, and others you have concerns. Any theoretical reason why you would see bleeding with this agent?
No, I don't think that there's enough that we know enough yet. Certainly a lot of investigation and what was the exact cause, but it's always always better to hold a trial early than to let it go on, and better to investigate and make sure that providers are aware, patients are aware, and they can appropriately consent and also be on the lookout for side effects of that nature. If hemoglobins are dropping or patients present with bleeding, to be more prepared. So probably a good thing to put things on hold earlier rather than later. But no, I don't have a good answer to why that would be happening.
I'm curious also, we didn't see any data at ASCO in terms of tumor treating fields in ovarian cancer, although we did see a phase 3 trial in lung cancer, not small cell lung cancer, that was positive survival that people are trying to figure out. But I'm curious, have you ever had a patient go on a trial tumor treating fields with ovarian cancer, and what did you see?
Yeah, it's a. I think that the device is amazing. It is very thought provoking, and of course exciting to see that this is now also an approved treatment in some of the other diseases. We did have the trial open here at Ohio State and enrolled a fair bit of patients on, and the patients would be coming around with their backpacks. Very curious to see the final results of that trial, and but I hear that should be that overall was well tolerated, and curious to see when we see those final results.
And of course, that study, I guess, is going to look at it combined with paclitaxel. Correct. The one thing I have heard about it is, I've only heard about it, I've only talked to a few docs who actually use this in ovarian. Of course, as you say, GBM, another story. But I have heard about some like dermatologic irritation underneath the arrays. Did you observe that in any of your patients?
So we did have the study open here, but I have to admit that I personally did not treat any patients that actually had the device. So hard for me to comment like how often they would have the rashes. I would have to be honest with you there.
So I want to get your thoughts in terms of endometrial cancer. Of course, as you mentioned, we saw two gigantic phase 3 important trials presented very recently in that situation. Before I get to that, though, just kind of curious, so this has really been coming up in almost every program we do, the issue of chemotherapy shortage and the treatment of all these patients. I'm curious what the situation is at Ohio State what you recommend or think should be done in situations where either you have a carbo shortage or cyst shortage or both.
Yeah, it's very, very concerning. We have been fortunate here that our pharmacy has been able to do a lot of preventative. We're right on it and have done very well in securing carboplatin or cisplatin. We're certainly very cautious with our use. If we can avoid it in a platinum resistant setting, that we don't use our platinum agents and make sure that we have it available for our curative intent settings. We may have to go from AUC of 6 to AUC of 5 to save a little bit more. But we have had it on hand. We haven't had to deny it or decline it for any patients that have not been able to get it. So I'm very fortunate there. So I think it's definitely, I'm glad that the Society of Gynecologic Oncology also is bringing it, obviously in the news everywhere, but bringing it up to our government also, that there should be access to these very basic, very much necessary drugs. Regarding your question about the use of it now.
What do you do? Or what would you recommend?
Yeah, if we don't have it available, I think in a mismatch repair deficient situation, I think that would be the easiest answer to go with. And it could, with how active immunotherapy is and the trials that are ongoing of single agent immunotherapy versus chemotherapy. Obviously, we can only do those trials if we think that they're going to be at least as effective, if not better. So for those patients, yes, I think dropping the chemotherapy if in the setting of a shortage is not unreasonable. Do we know for sure that it's going to work? But if you do that, there's always the option then of, if you start with immunotherapy, that you still can add the chemotherapy if you're not seeing a good response. That almost gets to more creative oncology, I would say, and certainly not something you would do outside of a trial or outside of a shortage, but during a time of a shortage for those specific populations where you have very, very effective alternative treatments, I think is a good way to spare a very, very precious drug.
So you commented going through ASCO, some of the data was presented from the RUBY trial. Of course, there was also the NRG trial with pembrolizumab, RUBY trial with dostarlimab. First of all, in general, I guess one of the questions is, now that we have chemo plus IO in the first line, is that something that you think is preferable as opposed to holding off and then giving lenvatinib pembro? And so I'm mainly talking about MS stable endometrial cancer to start with.
Yes. So I think a couple of things to that. So that's a difficult question. We don't have a head-to-head here. Before this day, for if we're talking about the microsatellite stable population, going back to chemo, we don't know if that was any better than lenvatinib. If they've had chemotherapy before and now with this, with their first recurrence, going to chemo versus lenvatinib pembrolizumab, I think a lot of us have jumped to lenvatinib pembrolizumab combination, as that is very, very effective. And the trial LEAP-001 is probably reading out in the next 1 to 2 years. So that will be very interesting to see if len-pem is going to be more effective or similar to carboplatin paclitaxel. But is that still the standard at this point after seeing the data in a mismatch stable population also? Really, the new standard is likely going to be chemotherapy with IO for everybody. So what should we go back to at the time of recurrence? Should that be chemotherapy with IO or len-pem? I think both are reasonable options. For my patients, I've been having discussions with them, kind of what's the different side effect profile? What are they looking at? What do they, hair loss always comes up with these things. Some people are very much against it, but some people who have poorly controlled hypertension, for example, or renal disease may not be good candidates for lymphadenant pembrolizumab. And in that case, chemotherapy with IO may be a better option. So very dependent on your patient's comorbidities, what they desire. And but I don't think we don't know that one's better than the other, but we have two good options now, certainly at the time of recurrence. The chemotherapy negative population, I think the answer is a little bit easier.
So what about the choice of IO? If you had the choice of either dostarlimab or pembrolizumab, either in the MS stable or MSI situation, any preference?
I don't. I personally don't see a lot of difference between the IO agents as far as the toxicity that develops with them or ease of giving. They're both every 3 weeks with chemotherapy and every 6 weeks in the maintenance phase. So I think there's that doesn't make much of a difference. Sadly, a lot of it is driven probably by what the patient's insurance will allow and pay for, whatever we can do to not have the patient pay for it out of pocket for such an effective drug. But I think if we compare between, and hard to compare between trials, but they both compare to their placebo groups and comparator groups. All the trials are a little bit different, but seem overall, whether it's a single agent or as in combination with chemotherapy, similar activity across both dostarlimab and pembrolizumab at least. That doesn't mean that I think all IO agents are exactly the same. There may be some differences.
Well, we have data to look at. I mean, it's indirect comparison, but It certainly looks pretty similar. So I would just finish out with a couple of words about cervical cancer. You were reviewing the data, looking at pembro plus chemo, first-line metastatic disease. How do you think through second-line therapy?
Once they've had chemotherapy in this situation, yeah. So initially that was, I think now single agent immunotherapy is not so much a thing anymore as all patients that are PD-L1 are hopefully getting pembrolizumab or immunotherapy along with their chemotherapy for metastatic disease. So single agent is out. That doesn't mean combination is out. I think the trials are even more important there to look at how can we overcome IO resistance or progression on or after IO. Can you use combinations of whether it's IO with an antivascular, IO with different IO mechanisms, whether it's CTLA-4, LAG, TIM-3, any of the other compounds that you can combine to overcome this. But there is a good alternative to immunotherapy too with another antibody drug conjugate, tisotumab vedotin, that targets tissue factor. So that's actually I think a really nice option now after for second line treatment, which can be given as a single agent. Also, it's every 3 weeks, so a pretty convenient dosing schedule and overall fairly well tolerated. But also, again, the ocular warnings. Again, you get into the same as what we discussed about the mirvetuximab, that still patients are going to need their eye exams frequently to be able to continue this.
What about the cold pack on the eyes? Is that something people generally use? Do you use that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very important part. The vasoconstrictive drops, as well as the cold packs over their eyes, same mechanism, really, that it's vasoconstrictive. So really trying to not get any blood or any absorption in the eye, mainly the conjunctiva. And it does seem to be very well. Once those preventative measures were implemented, we certainly saw a lot less of the ocular toxicity. And overall, the ocular toxicity is actually quite low.
Yeah, I think probably the very few physicians who even have used this drug What can you talk a little bit more about exactly like what you do, when they take the drops, when they put the cold pack on? Does it bother patients or not a big deal?
It doesn't seem to bother patients very much. I think just the fact that you can do something to prevent ocular toxicity, the eye is always a scary thing for many patients. Nobody wants to have any issues with that. Scary for patients, scary for us physicians, and specifically not eye doctors, and such a vital part. So there's not much resistance there for using the eye drops. Very important that patients start the day before already, and then getting the taking good care of their eyes, getting the right before infusion, using the vasoconstrictive eye drops, using the cold compresses before, during, after the infusion also, and continue to do that with the drops multiple times a day during the day of infusion, and then have several days afterwards also with the drops. Fortunately, it's hard to remember because there's several different drops that they take at different time points. Also, it's a very well laid out schedule. So the important part is telling your patient about it and then giving them the calendar and the schedule that they can mark and really exactly follow. They have the schedule on the website also for Tizet Mepfidotin and similar for any of the other drugs, especially for the eye care, with an exact plan of doing it. So I would encourage everybody to each time, again, make sure you print it off for the providers, but also for the patients, that you really adhere to this. It makes a huge difference.
How much total time did they end up having the cold packs on? Multiple hours?
It is multiple hours. I would have to look back again. I think at least, well, during, after the infusion, so at least 4 hours, if not longer, in total. So yes, very, very, yeah, it is inconvenient, but yes, people also sit with their hands in ice baths or their feet, for right. Some of the, pegylated liposomal doxorubicin or paclitaxel neuropathy, as preventative measures. Similar idea there.
Right. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Have you seen useful responses to sotumab?
Yes, I've seen some. Certainly we would think that you're somewhere around 24% or so, response rates among all patients. So that would mean about one out of every four patients that you treat. So yes, stable disease, partial responses. I'm still waiting for the first complete response to it. But certainly, absolutely, just as with any other drug, not everybody responds. But yes, overall, I think relatively well tolerated and seeing at least some tumor shrinkage.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Backus, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.